Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast by Literal Humans. As always, I'm one of your co-hosts, Paul David, CEO and co-founder of Literal Humans, content marketing and digital marketing agency. I'll let my co-host, Will, introduce himself.
William Gadsby-Pete, Chief Strategy Officer of Literal Humans. Very excited to be joining you on this another wonderful podcast of Tech Can't Save Us.
And we're very excited to have as a guest today, Paul Finnis, who is the CEO of the Learning Foundation and one of the initiatives of Learning Foundation, the Digital Poverty Alliance. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you very much. Great to see you.
Thank you for fielding our completely out of the blue email. We read about you in the Digital Poverty Alliance, and we said, this seems like an interesting guy to talk to you about digital divide and digital poverty. So we wrangled you onto the show. We really appreciate that.
I'm very happy about that. I mean, not only do I love talking about it, but as you can imagine, it's a bit of a passion. And, you know, watching it unfold in front of us and stuff, it has just been brilliant. So thanks for the opportunity to come and talk a little bit about it.
You bet, absolutely. Well, as we always do on Tech Can't Save Us, we want to jump into the headlines first and keep your audience abreast of what's going on in the news. So one of the first headlines that we shared with our guest Paul was, we don't always like to jump back to what we all went through, but COVID, coronavirus, and its impact on digital poverty. So just curious, you know, we shared a piece from the University of Cambridge about this, about struggle that a lot of families were going through in terms of pay the Wi-Fi or feed the children. Which is a very stark choice a lot of families had to make. So Paul, just curious about, what do you think the impact was of coronavirus and COVID on digital poverty, specifically in the UK?
Well, I mean, I think the obvious one for me is that I'd go back a couple of years, actually back to 2017, when we first started really looking at the issue that we kept uncovering, which was huge numbers of school children specifically, because the Learning Foundation works with tech and supporting schools in embedding tech into the way they deliver learning. And what we kept finding was these enormous numbers of young people who were not connected at home at all, or had very limited connectivity, maybe a, you know, mobile phone. Mum had a mobile phone, or there were three of them and only one, you know, one old device to go between them and things. So we started to explore that. And what I found actually was that we talked to people about it and people sort of didn't really think it was an issue. I think generally people thought that most people were connected and most people were sort of okay and things. It's one of those kind of myths that surrounds the tech sector and stuff. And so we managed to gather together organizations who were interested, because they sort of understood that there must be an issue if you are disconnected and, you know, if you're poor, then maybe you struggle to kind of afford, particularly connectivity, of course. And then the pandemic came. And what the pandemic did for us was to suddenly demonstrate to everybody, not just how important it is for all of us on a day-to-day basis, but also sort of showed up just how awful it must be. And if you think about what that must have been like during lockdown, just how many people, I mean, how big the issue was and how deep the issue was in terms of the numbers of people who couldn't get on. So from my point of view, the coronavirus and the lockdown and stuff was a positive in some ways, because it helped me to and helped us to talk to a wider population about the issue.
The next piece that we shared with you from Schools Week, I think it was a piece by Jane Reed. There are some stunning statistics in that about, you know, this estimate that 22% of the population, you know, was experiencing digital poverty. I think they did a study as well that showed something about only 13% of teachers reported that all their students had adequate access to a device. This is before the pandemic. So do these figures, they ring true for you? Are you seeing this in the work that you're doing? And sort of what's your response to these kind of numbers?
I think they're an underestimate. I think they're a huge underestimate. Just to qualify that, what I would say is that it depends on how you define these things. And one of the things that I found, so to give an example, when we first started looking at this, really the only information around was produced by an organization called ONS, which is one of those kind of slightly sort of government related national figures and things. And what they had was that the figure said something like 97%, high 90% of people were connected to the internet, right? And I remember thinking, that just can't be true. This was kind of 2017, 2018, and say when we first started investigating, it just can't be true. So I rang them and I said, so tell me more about that. You know, what questions do you ask and that kind of stuff? And what's your cohort of people? And the question they asked was, have you at any time in the last 3 months accessed the internet? Yes or no? Right? And that was the only question. So, of course, most people said yes, because, you know, whether it was on a mobile phone, because it didn't talk about the quality or where that was or what they were doing. You know, to sign on, as you know, for benefits, you have to go online. So almost everybody somehow or other. So it presented this kind of picture of people. So what we did was to say, what we need to do is understand this in a bit more detail. And I'm pleased to say that Ofcom and others have now added into that research, so we know a bit more. So for instance, if in terms of numbers of people who don't have anything at all, you might be talking about 1 or 2 million households, perhaps. But if you were to say that you've got the kit that you need, got the connectivity even perhaps that you need, but you've got no skills, so you're not using it for anything other than playing games like my kids or whatever, then the answer is that something like 12 million people in the UK right now might or don't have the skills that they need in order to get on with work and life and that kind of stuff. So definition is really important. And one of the issues has been that all the research organizations having slightly different definitions about all of these things. So our response to that, by the way, was to produce what's called the UK Digital Poverty Evidence Review, which we just produced. And if people want to go and have a look at our website, it's actually not just a summation of what the evidence says out there, but also it explodes some of the kind of myths and the nuances and this kind of thing behind all of this. Because the reality is, until you understand what the size and nature of the problem is, it's very difficult to respond to it. You can tell I'm a bit of a talker, so sorry about that, Paul and William. But the only other thing I would say is that our view is that the number is going to get worse this year, and that's because of the huge impact on household finances. And Paul, you talked right at the beginning about the decisions that absolutely genuinely families are having to make. And there was a quote making a decision between data and dinner, for instance. Data's not even going to be in that picture, is it? It's going to be between dinner and paying the electricity bill, so data is going to be even further down the list and things. And so our worry is, not just to where it's a very real expectation, is that the numbers of people able to engage with the digital world is going to get even bigger over the next year or two.
I think as well, kind of in some of those pieces, one of the things that really emphasizes that how big the divide is, a lot of the conversations like, people just have basic access to the internet. And obviously those numbers are startlingly high as well. But even, moving forward to like what most education, solutions providers are currently coming up with in terms of remote learning, that it goes way further than that. It's not assuming, you have an iPad in the house. It's assuming every child in your household has a full-time device that can load an app. There's the in-house, knowledge of using that kind of software, which is a big assumption. And, you start to see how, along with kind of households that maybe an income bracket that people aren't surprised to see issues getting online with. But, middle-class households would struggle to supply 3 laptops per child plus, decent Wi-Fi, all of the download software and stuff you have to download. So you really do start to see how you can quickly start to grasp how much it adds to an inequality problem that is already stark. That, it really isn't just sort of it's only the bottom 20% of income households that are dealing with this. I honestly wouldn't be surprised if, half the households in the country struggle with this. I my family growing up were pretty, affluent. My dad would have told me to bugger off if I suggested that me and both my brothers should have a laptop each to, be able to access schoolwork. It really is a lot of money and a lot of software and a lot of in-house knowledge that I just don't think the majority of the country has, let alone the 90 to 95% you would hope for from an education solution that we're hoping to provide our entire country with.
I'm detecting 2 new supporters, I have to say. You're absolutely right, William. And so for me, again, the sort of general response to the questions earlier on about how did the coronavirus affect the country and the world and us and stuff is about that understanding. And I'm pleased to say that one of the growing understandings, particularly in the last couple of years, has been exactly that. One device per family. The DfE, for instance, understands that one device per family is not enough. Friends the other day said, my kids could not share a banana. So this idea that they were going to be able to share an iPad or a device, so who's going to win? The biggest kid or the oldest kid or the but then equally, mum and dad need to be going online. So you're absolutely right. With that one, there are obviously people who are, higher up the list in terms of priority. But we've talked to, obviously thousands of schools over time. And even though we tend to focus on the schools where they have a highest level of what we call pupil premium children, so children whose families are in circumstances which means that they might be qualified for free school meals, that kind of thing. We work across the piece, and there are plenty of schools who would describe themselves exactly as middle-class schools who absolutely struggle for exactly that reason you say, William, is their mums and dads are coping okay, probably less so at their own, right? In terms of, we're all struggling a bit finding that extra money for the gas bills and the electricity bills and the petrol and everything else. But say that exactly that, because they're not getting any extra help. They're not getting any government support. but these families exactly are having to find, you know, connectivity and, you know, a device for more than one child. So again, it all comes down to how you define all of that and things. On the positive side, there's so much. I like the title of the podcast. I would say tech can't save us, but of course, it's one of my mantras has been sort of tech can save us kind of thing. You know, is that there are really opportunities in here? And the mantra I was brought up with when I first joined the Learning Foundation was, it's not the device, it's what the device does that's important. And I was like, yeah, okay, good. So off I went with this kind of mantra in my head. And then increasingly, I kept thinking, yeah, but you haven't got a device, so we haven't got connectivity and stuff. You're not even starting off. You know, one of my chairman has always got some great lines. He said, learning to use a device without a device is like learning to ride a horse without a horse. You can sort of get how it would go, but you imagine, you know, the point about that was that there is hundreds of millions of pounds spent on providing digital skills training. But we kept saying, well, but why is this huge number of people who are just not taking that up? And that's because they haven't got a device. They don't really care. They don't really understand what's the point of it all and stuff. So the job for us is more than just getting devices and connectivity out there.
Yeah, to that point, I'm struck that, you know, there's a framing piece of this conversation that I think, you know, we take the idea of digital transformation, digital inclusion as sort of, you know, inherently a net positive. But one thing I appreciated from the conversation.com piece that we shared called The Downside of Digital Transformation, they talk about two underlying assumptions that, you know, that everyone can or should interact digitally. You know, the first assumption being that people who can't access digital services are somehow problematic or deficient in some way. And the second being that digital inclusion, you know, by giving folks more access to digital services, that will, you know, automatically increase their social inclusion. And neither of those are necessarily true. And I think The Guardian even came down on the side of what The Conversation came up with, or at least this author from The Conversation, that online must not be the only option. So just curious, Paul, like, what is the, is there an analog side to this? Is there a way to still provide non-digital options that still include people and sort of get at the core of digital poverty and digital exclusion? Just curious what you've seen in your work.
I think the short answer is no. I think the reality, and read the UK evidence review for that, because it's got all the figures and stuff in it, but it's not really about that ultimately. What the UK evidence review is very clear about is that we live in a digital world. Decisions are being made about us. And particularly interestingly, of people who might be in poverty or vulnerable, because health services, datification, the use of data, big data, of course, making decisions on their behalf about where hospitals might be and where GP surgeries might be and how people might access it and stuff. The reality is that, and that's not going to get less, that's going to get more. You know, we know that government and others are increasingly digitizing their services. And at the moment, the only requirement on a government department is to recognize that some people aren't going to be able to access the services digitally. And therefore, an offline version needs to be made available. We want to change that narrative. We want to say, look, there certainly was a time, and you guys will know much more about this than I do, but there was a time when digital was a kind of nice to have, wasn't it? But in the last 10 years, it's moved into a must-have. And we need to communicate that to people. We need to communicate with them that it has moved on. And I would love to change the narrative to the point where a government department, if it wants to digitize the way you get your, you know, your driving license or your passport or whatever is now online, is that they are required then to help people who can't get online to get online to do that kind of thing in the future, however that might be. So yes, absolutely, in the short term, there will be and there needs to be ways of ensuring that people who are offline can engage and can do all of these kind of things. But that's not going to be the long-term answer, unfortunately. We need to make sure that everybody can, you know, can and does get online.
My view on that side of things is, like, the wider question of digital and analog is far more like, I think you just invest to make digital less terrible than it sometimes is. And, you know, in terms of, there's kind of a meta conversation there about, you know, the downsides of digitalization wrapped up in, you know, bad sides of stuff like social media and et cetera, that we've seen plenty of news coverage for. And I do kind of agree with Paul in some regards of, like, I think the horse has already bolted and you can't really stop the digitalization that's going to happen. And we can't really revert back to that analog world. What we can do is go, okay, cool, this is here to stay. How do we make this so that it is something that is, at least, if not for the most part, beneficial to everyone who's on it, at least not actively harming them with regards to, you know, to have an iPhone or whatever it is to access services online, but then also getting downside. So yeah, I kind of agree of sort of like, let's work together to make the digital world safer, better, and far, you know, more productive and just positive generally. But yeah, I can't really, I personally, but then again, I work in tech, so I would think this, I can't see a world in which there's enough of a movement to push back to analog that, you know, it picks up any momentum. You know, it's probably here to stay for better or for worse. So we kind of just got to make the best we can of it.
Thank you. You said that so much better than I do, but that's exactly right. And we developed five principles that came out of our UK evidence review. And what William was touching on there was what I would say would be our second principle, which is just to read it as digital should fit into people's lives, particularly the most disadvantaged, not be an additional burden. And so you're absolutely right, William. I think the bigger task for the Digital Poverty Alliance and for all of us is actually to make that kind of world happen. It certainly doesn't happen at the moment. As you know, the vast majority of corporate, particularly websites and things, are inaccessible to people, you know, from a whole variety. We've all had experience of that, even those of us who consider ourselves to be reasonably tech savvy. You know, you find you're struggling actually to get the information you want, or going around and around in circles and things. Now, you know, I would love it to be an option. I think for a long time I felt that it was being impressed upon us, and, you know, we couldn't stop it. And I would love to be an option. I'm all for that. But now I can't see how that's going to change. And I was just saying, William, by the way, that one of our principles now is that digital should fit into people's lives, particularly the most disadvantaged, not be an additional burden. And I think that sums it up really well. On the same point, though, is that if you are a government department, let's say, it doesn't have to be a government department if you're a business, but, you know, government department's a good example. Let's say the job centre, you have to continue to provide premises, people, support, everything physically in order to provide for an ever-declining numbers of people who are going to be accessing it that way. And so there's a real cost-benefit thing going on here as well, which you have to argue is absolutely going to be fundamental to government decisions over the next year or two. And it, of course, probably always is, but, you know, it's going to be even more fundamental. And give you an example, the piece of research we saw, it was done quite a while ago, but in Australia, by one of the kind of big consulting firms, showed that an interaction with a then Australian, but would apply anywhere, I think, an Australian government official was something like $40. Per intervention. That same thing happening online was 50 cents. So you can see where that's going to go. I mean, even if you're just making these decisions on a financial basis, which way would you go? You know, the same must be true for companies offering services and products and stuff, you know, is that if you, instead of having premises on the high street and everything else, of course, there is a downside to that. And I'd happily explore all of that with you guys today as well. But at the moment, I'm all about enabling people to be given the choice to decide whether, you know, how they want to proceed with their lives. And as you say, some people might do the thing that they have to do online and that's it. And they don't want any more of it. And, you know, they do the banking or they vote or they whatever they have to do. And others will start with that and think, oh, actually, you know, this is a bit fun. I can now do the following things as well. I can play games or I can, you know, catch up with my family in Australia or whatever it is, you know, and everybody will find their own way in that place, won't they?
I sometimes worry that we've just seen so many bad applications of digital that we forget how much money and access it can, you know, save. There's, I think, a lot of the emotive examples are like, oh, well, you know, this 80-year-old pensioner can no longer go to their local branch of, you know, the banking and get their pension or whatever. And you're like, yeah, but that 80-year-old pensioner probably doesn't want to travel 40 minutes to their regional banking branch to do that. Like, you know, they would probably rather do that directly from, you know, the comfort of their sitting room. It's more a case of being able to educate that person and supply them with the tools. As well, I think there are some things digital will never replace. There should always be a physical and in-person component of certain services. But, you know, there are some things that I just think, you know, personally, I don't know many people who would have any problem if we all voted digitally. Like, it's not that much fun going to polling stations. We've seen, you know, a lot of potential ways that can kind of harm a democracy recently across the world, because there's stuff you can do to squeeze those that a lot more than you can digitally. Obviously, there are other stuff you can do online. I just think, yeah, it's more a question of, as a society, putting pressure and oversight on the virtuous development of tech and us understanding there are certain services that you can never digitize and that's not in the conversation. But there are also plenty that, yeah, it saves governments money and saves people, you know, time and effort and hopefully money as well. We just need to give them the tools and make sure that they're not then also getting taken advantage of with, you know, the bad actors of the digital world online.
Just to bring in a real world example for us before we pivot to you know, more of your background, Paul, is my dad is turning 80, God bless him, in January, and he's a veteran, you know, so he worked in the Air Force back in the 60s in the U.S. Air Force, and, he moved locations, moved house, essentially, in Pennsylvania, where I'm from, and because of the way the Veterans Administration is set up, that means he has a different HQ, you know, for the Veterans Administration, and he's had a whale of a time trying to switch from the previous location he was at to the new location in Philadelphia, and I was just chatting with him, and I'm thinking to myself, like, how is this not all sorted for you digitally? Like, surely there's, they have to be thinking, okay, these are people who are veterans. They have different ailments. They're older. They can just press a few buttons and switch you from the Allentown office to the, Philadelphia office of the VA. And I'm just like racking my brain. He's sending, pieces of mail back and forth, snail mail and calling people and stuff like that. It took him months, literally, to switch locations. And I was just sort of like, there has to be a better digital way for someone who to some degree struggles with technology because he's older, and not necessarily because he's older, but because he's learning new technologies on the go, for this to happen. And I'm just sort of like, why hasn't, I actually have a friend who worked at a consulting firm on this very problem with the Veterans Administration as kind of an outside provider, but yeah.
Great that he has you to support him. One of the things I would say is that we absolutely know that whatever we do nationally, all of us do nationally in terms of trying to drive this, in terms of making the digital world more accessible and safe and all of those kind of things that we'd all want and things, is that we think that the change is actually going to happen locally. That it's actually going to be about what we call a trusted face and a trusted place. So it's going to be places that people do feel comfortable. As you say, Paul, go to a library, which is actually three bus rides away and it's raining and it's, and they can't really do all of that. But they are going to pop down to the shop or they're going to go to their GP surgery or whatever. And it will come down to those individual connections and things. So it kind of answers that other point you were making there, William, that absolutely you can't digitize everything. And I suppose you wondered the question with, but you can't digitize friendships. So you could argue, but I suspect that you can do that too. But trusted faces and trusted places is really important. So people that people feel they can talk to and share with and stuff.
Hear more about your work. Also, we'd love to just first things first, hear about the Learning Foundation, hear about the initiative you started, the Digital Poverty Alliance. Give us the lowdown on how it got started and just where this work came from.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I touched on it a little bit earlier on, really, and that's to say that the Learning Foundation has 21 year. We're celebrating our 21st birthday this year. History of working with schools, and very roughly, about the first half of that was piloting projects with schools to find out what worked and what didn't work, and the second half has been much more around us working on a day to day basis with schools to help them to embed technology into the way they deliver learning, but also the way that they manage the school, for instance. One of the things we found, though, was very large numbers of schools not able to engage. And the reality is that, as we all know, the schools got far too little money, far too many other things to do. They've got Ofsted meetings coming up. They're struggling with recruiting people. And also, there isn't a wealth of individuals around who have that balance between an understanding of ed tech, as we call it, education technology, and the reality of delivering education. So the trustees basically said to me, is there a way of us enabling particularly children and young people who were not connected at home to get to them so that they had the choice at least at home whether they went online or not? Because the reality is, Paul, was that most young people were anyway doing that, even if it wasn't part of the way that education was delivered at school. They were, going, wouldn't you? You go online, wouldn't you, to do some research, or you watch a little, excerpt of a Shakespeare play, or, remind yourself how you do work out surface area, and you do all of those things and collaborate with friends and stuff. So we started work on what's now called the Digital Poverty Alliance, which is really much more broadly about enabling everybody to access the digital world, and as we say, when, where, and how they want to, because, having a mobile phone is not enough, and having to go down, as lots of young people were doing, to sit outside McDonald's or wherever it might be in order to get access to Wi-Fi in order to do their homework, just feels like that's not a society that we should be operating in and things. So the trustees were brilliant in giving us the ability to expand the way that we responded to the problem of the school children, particularly being disconnected, and their families. And then I'm pleased to say that the Currys rang. I'm struggling with COVID in 2020, that kind of Christmas period, but only 2 weeks off. I got COVID. Thank you very much. But as I was emerging from that in early January, I got a phone call from Currys saying, we want to help. Of course, we share similar things. They want everybody to enjoy technology, and so do we, kind of thing. The link was really obvious for us, but they actually ended up donating £1 million, which was fantastic. So numbers of devices went out to teachers and helped to establish the Digital Poverty Alliance. And since then, we've had others join us to help to carry on that story and things. So it's been a very exciting last 12, 18 months. And I think that if you told me 18 months ago that the DfE, the Department for Education, were going to give 1.5 million devices to school kids, I probably would have said, wow, that'd be fantastic. Unfortunately, they handed them out without connectivity and without support and without any kind of sustainable thing. You know, so for instance, digital poverty is not something that, you know, like I say to them, what happens next year when 700,000 more kids arrive at school? You know, going to find another 700,000 laptops and stuff. So sustainability is really key for us. So the Learning Foundation still works with schools to help them to do that. But now we've got this deep, what we call the Digital Poverty Alliance to help. What we call about connecting the dots, basically, joining the dots, because there's so many organizations out there doing great things, but we wanted to make sure that that was strategic and sustainable and things.
To that wider, you know, connecting of the dots, like, you know, what is the, sorry, this is probably quite a difficult question to answer, but, you know, how is it do you think we actually ultimately solve this? You know, other countries treat Wi-Fi like railroads and, you know, there's a free countrywide network that everyone can access. You know, is it stuff like that combined with, you know, teaching in schools of how to use devices along with obviously actual accessibilities to said devices? You know, what's kind of your more meta plan along with helping, you know, specifically school children each year access the digital world?
Yeah. Yeah. You caught me just a couple of 3 months early on that, because having produced the UK evidence review, we are now developing what we call the National Delivery Plan, which is going to encompass all of that. You know, but the answer to your question is, I look across the States, Paul, where your home country, and there's been, of the £1 trillion infrastructure budget, something like $65 billion has been set aside to enable people to access broadband wherever they are, because they have huge issues about rural areas and things like that in the US and stuff. But nonetheless, there's an absolute commitment to making that happen. But you're right, William. We look across at countries. We had conversations with BBC News way, way back. And the director of digital there was Danish. And one of the things you were saying is, we don't have a problem with remote learning. Because for 10 years, they've been investing in enabling children and young people and school children to be able to do that. So they just switched from one to another. So it worked extremely well. The answer to your question, Paul, it's going to be a combination of all that. I absolutely believe that. I mean, we've got all of the bits and pieces that we need in the UK. We're lucky we've got a kind of relatively alive economy. I know it's struggling at the moment. So for instance, one of the things we say about the Digital Poverty Alliance is that we want to own little and inspire much. And the reason we say that is because, and we're only six of us in the team, is that there are already huge organizations doing lots of stuff in this space. What we want to do is to enable them to do that better and in a way that, and I'll give you one quick example. One organization who I love hugely, I have to say, but I won't say who they are. They before we started working together, they handed out at one point something like 10,000 devices to schools. And they know that only half of them have ever been switched on. So that's kind of, you know, what I mean is that I wanted to make sure that all of that energy and resource and time and money that people were putting into this translated into change. And so the dots are there or thereabouts. I'll give you one more example, and that is that we did some work with teachers. And one of the things we found out is if you want to deliver digital education, you need to make sure the teachers can do that. What we found out is something nearly half of the teachers that we surveyed said that they did not have at home the access to digital that they needed. Right. So how on earth are they going to begin to, you know, because they have the same problems, because teaching families the same as any other family. You know, they got three kids and, you know, one device and, you know, not enough broadband and that kind of stuff. So what I'm saying is that there are also some big, important jigsaw puzzle bits missing, which need to be fixed as well.
Yeah, I remember hearing sort of anecdotally from friends who were teachers that, like, you know, for in the first few months when everything switched to digital and education, you know, the first 15 minutes of every class was, you know, your mic's not on or your video's off or, you know, all these issues that people just truly like learning in real time how to digitally transform themselves in order to be a learner or a teacher in those settings, which is really a challenge. But hearing those little 15 minutes of each call, each class really add up in terms of loss of learning time and, you know, substantive knowledge and things like that, that are real issues.
I've got two small boys, a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old. And you add to that the whole process of suddenly realizing that you've got to, you know, help your children to learn and things. It was incredibly difficult. As you say, devices not working. And sometimes, because a 10-year-old does occasionally break things, for instance, that kind of thing. And this idea that DfE, you hand out 1.5 million devices and expect all the school kids to join a Teams meeting on Monday, you know, it just doesn't work like that, does it, unfortunately? So, no, you're absolutely right, Paul. It's that, you know, those anecdotes are true, and they're true at scale, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear any other, Pawnee, other examples that you have, any success stories, particularly around the space of, like, government stepping up. Doesn't have to be the UK, but anywhere you've seen government or industry step up in a way that really fostered, you know, highly effective digital transformation and got rid of, you know, digital exclusion, digital poverty.
To be honest, I haven't seen very much of that. So, for instance, I understand that the huge investment currently going on in the States, and of course you'll be aware all of, you know, No Child Left Behind, which was a program to ensure that every child could have access to a device and that kind of thing. So I think the will is there. The reality is, though, that turning that into reality is not easy, particularly, in a country the size of the US. So countries like Denmark and Finland, for instance, Scandinavian countries are often heralded as countries that are using digital in a way that is transformative and is available and is. And so, for instance, in Sweden, I think I'm right in saying is that they're committed to ensuring that every school child has a device of their own by 2025, something like that. And interesting, same in Scotland. In Scotland, they have a commitment right now that within the current parliament, every school child will have a device of their own by the end of this current parliament, which is, you know, a year, 2 years down the line. And so there are plenty of examples of countries that have done bits of it and doing some of it extremely well. But one of the aspects of the work we're doing is global. One of the things that absolutely we're getting contacts from, you know, India and Eastern Europe and a whole variety of other places is that there's definitely sharing that we could be doing between us globally. And we particularly linked up with one or two organizations in the US who are just so knowledgeable and so able, particularly the National Digital Inclusion Alliance, which is sort of similar to us. So yeah, it's a global problem. It's, you know, something like half of the population in the UK of the world are not online. One of the lines I loved hearing during the pandemic was this idea that the world's population is only as strong as its weakest link. In a way, it doesn't matter how digital we are all going to be in the developed world, if large chunks of the world remain digitally disconnected, and then we're still not, you know, using the resource and the potential of us globally as a planet to respond to all of the other major issues we've got hanging around us at the moment, particularly environment, for instance.
Yeah, I do think that kind of one of the sadder things from countries like the UK and up until recently the US is we have the resources to fix this problem, but we don't have the drive to, and it's bad short-term stupid thinking. It, like, of course, if you give every child in your country access to the internet and all the font of all human knowledge, in combination with hopefully some pretty strict guardrails, because there's also some very horrible stuff online, of course the world gets better. What greater productivity investment could you see in 20 years time than making sure every kid has access to the internet? And it just, you know, I think Labour's 2019 manifesto under Corbyn had free Wi-Fi. I'm not sure if Starmer's does anymore. I know the Conservatives aren't thinking about it right now. So it does just seem like a lot of other bits of Europe, you know, stole a 10-year march on us and are just already reaping the benefits now. But, you know, in 10, 20 years time, when we're still having a conversation about free Wi-Fi and, you know, they have an entire generation that's completely digitally accessed and skilled, you know, imagine the entrepreneurs and the companies and the SaaS companies that will be coming out of Sweden and Scandinavia and Germany. You know, it is mind-boggling that we don't see the investment and the return on investment opportunity there as a nation, because it's just so obvious.
Fantastic. Well, I want to spend more time with you guys, definitely. I want to talk about this more. If any of your listeners are interested, we are absolutely interested in developing a proper business plan for HM Treasury, because you're absolutely right. The return on investment and stuff is really, really important. But and it's there, and it's not expensive. It's a relatively inexpensive thing to do. Devices and connectivity and stuff, and yet the benefits for everybody and for the country as a whole, I have to say, are huge. And there were so many other things caught up in what you're saying I'd love to spend time on, but I think we need to move on too, unfortunately.
And just to connect the dots too, we had a recent previous podcast with Professor Adam Gans at Story Futures, and they're doing some interesting work with getting, you know, AR, VR, and MR, mixed reality, involved in workforce development. And I believe they have a strong partnership with a number of organizations and with the government as well for that. So I think, you know, that's just another area where how do we get folks digitally included using some of these innovative tools to heighten their, you know, capacity in the workplace, for example. So
I did listen to some of that. I listened to one or two of the podcasts and was completely fascinated by all of that. We're dealing with the fundamentals, but as you say, once we've got that, we've got all these brilliant things we can add on. Unfortunately, otherwise what happens is that the world carries on moving, and you know the technology. One of the other reasons we're a small organization is that everything moves so quickly that the bigger you are, the more difficult it is to respond to that kind of change and things. And one of our ambassadors, for instance, talks about this fantastic range of skills he's got as a kind of chief data officer and stuff. And yet he said at the end of his presentation how worried he is, because he knows 5 years from now none of that's going to mean anything. And I think that we talked about middle class and stuff earlier on, and even though the focus has to be, for me at least, on those people who are struggling in poverty, particularly because I do see digital as a way of enabling them to take control and to move out of poverty, because it, you know, enables you to get to work and learn and all those kind of bits and pieces. The reality is that this is something for all of us. Because if you think 5 years from now you'll be using the same systems and stuff, think again. And if you don't stay on top of your digital skills, then you will find yourself more and more disconnected. And I already am feeling disconnected from bits of my team who are so used, because they're all relatively young compared to me. I think everybody's young compared to me now. But is that they are using technology in a way that, and I've seen this in schools too. I've seen there's something beautiful, you know, about a 10-year-old kid working on a device in a way that doesn't look forced or anything. It's just you see them using it as a tool. Thinking about that one I saw just recently, I said to this, it was a boy, and I said, oh, by the way, you know, I know you're going up next year to senior school and stuff. You know, you're looking forward to that. And he said, no. And I said, well, why not? And he said, because they don't use devices. So he was going from a point of where he could use devices just naturally as part of the way that he did his work and stuff, going into, you know, into a desert. And Will, this picks up absolutely on your point about development. And I've always felt like if you could use digital for all the good reasons why it can help you to augment your learning and, you know, add to everything, it will naturally also produce people who have an interest in going on to be digital experts. And one of the big issues we have in this country at the moment is a lack of people who with digital skills for work. Rather than give that to them when they've left school, why not enable them to access it at school and be able to access it at home and everything else? And then my two kids, the eldest, absolutely loves his device and would love to. And I booked him in for a kind of introduction to coding and stuff, and he's really looking forward to that. The other one loves his device but couldn't care less, you know, and he just uses it and puts it down and goes and reads a book and stuff. So it engenders this interest in technology and things. And, you know, and I'm quite excited about all of that kind of thing, William, as clearly you are too.
Yeah, it strikes me as an employer. You know, one of the things we look at, we just went through a whole hiring process to bring on a new full-time designer. And one of the key things we look at is like, what tools have you used? You know, and usually they're digital tools for the most part. And what can you produce with those tools? Like that is even a more pressing question than where did you go to school, or, you know, what was your GPA, or, you know, and let me see your portfolio. Let me see the work that you've done using these digital tools, because that's going to be, you know, a good proxy for what you can do for our agency as well. So I just think it's so critical. And so I'm excited to have you on the podcast and have Professor Adam Gans on to talk about tech for workforce development. So
one of the things I loved about your workforce, apart from really being keen to hear more about the 4-day week thing, because I just love this idea, which I know you're involved in. But one of the things I loved about your looking at your workforce is where they are, because they are all over the place. And one of the things that I found, it's almost like a slow realization for me, is that when I'm recruiting remotely, I can recruit people wherever they are. I don't have to hope that they're going to want to wander into my office in central London or wherever it might be. So my team are literally all over the place, in Glasgow, in Sheffield, in Kent, in the south, you know, and you take that even a step further, don't you? So you have people in a whole variety of different countries. And I advertised our jobs on LinkedIn, which and I hadn't really thought about it, because getting all these applications from people in Spain and France. And originally I was like, oh, no, you know, and I was thinking, but, you know, why not? You know, I mean, it doesn't matter where they are and things nowadays. And if they've got skills to bring, then let's see them. I say, I love your team is everywhere. Makes getting together for the Christmas drinks a bit more difficult.
It does. And scheduling calls with clients on different coasts and different continents gets a little tricky. But yeah, I think we make it work for the most part. So. To of us into a lightning round where we, Will and I typically will alternate questions and just sort of ping you with some interesting thought-provoking questions here to just get to know you a bit better and understand your background. So I'll kick us off with the first question here. You mentioned you're not quite a techie, so this is a question to check the pulse on that, but curious to hear, you know, what kind of tech you work with on a daily basis, and if you could name a game-changing tech product that's really altered the way you work or live.
Yes, I'm not gonna take a complete pass on that, I have to say. But I have to say that one of the things about remote, of course, is exactly as you say, how do people come together and things. And so I have to say, at the moment, we are increasingly vested in Teams as and that suite of programs that Microsoft offer and things. But just from a very personal point of view, I've always really, really liked the whole concept of open source. And I think that it's a route that I would love to have spent more time understanding way back and things, because I just love that idea about equity of access and things not being based on how much things might cost us. Having said that, as a charity, obviously we tend to get things perhaps a bit cheaper than others and things. But so in terms of game changing software, that's a difficult one. I think that what would I pick? I couldn't put my finger on it. We have just literally recruited a digital comms person who has been actually working for us for a while now. She's been introducing us to different products all the time. And, you can see how slowly the kind of jigsaw puzzle, again, begins to fit together. So something that was a problem is no longer a problem anymore. So we've just came across something called Loom recently, which I quite like, which is just, gives you an opportunity to just do these little sort of, because we talk to schools about that all the time. Why, instead of the head teacher can just spend 3 minutes saying hello to parents, send them a little video out, and get an update rather than having to do a newsletter and all those kind of things, which we don't bother to read anymore. But I haven't got any game-changing software. I'm always worried also a little bit about the longevity of software. So for instance, Twitter, I wasn't really a big fan of that when it started stuff, but now I get it. And then the worry is that just as you're getting it and built it into your strategy and something, it suddenly disappears. Elon Musk decides to focus on the satellites rather than on Twitter and stuff. But yeah, so no, I can't pick one, I'm afraid.
We're also big fans of Loom, so we can mark that down as your answer.
Okay, great.
This next question kind of relates to something we touched upon in the main sort of chat. What do you think is one problem that tech absolutely can't solve for, and why?
I gave this some thought, and I come from the perspective, and I refer back to my previous answer and stuff. I honestly think that tech can, even if it can't solve everything, it can certainly facilitate the solution of things. I mean, Paul talked very positively about his father and things. And so, again, it's a problem. Tech isn't the answer in a way. It's just about communication, isn't it? It's just about communication, better communication and things, moving one thing from one place to another. And tech is the facilitator for that. And I'd like to say friendships, but, we've all got experience of people that we almost exclusively sometimes have a relationship with online now because, you've not met them and members of my team I've not met. People who form wonderful romantic relationships online and things. So no, I struggled to find something. One of the other things was that, Paul, you talked about veterans and stuff. I lived in Vietnam for many years, for 10 years and things. And I met wonderful veterans who were there to kind of visit where they'd been and to often, building schools and supporting youngsters to get to school and stuff. It was really eye-opening. But one of the things when I came back from Vietnam in 2015, I'd seen Asia just move ahead, leapfrog, because they were using digital in classrooms and stuff, actually beginning to really power forward with him. You were talking about that going on in Europe, and that's just, you should see it happening in Asia, guys. And then I came back to the UK and it looked like we'd gone backwards 10 years. Yeah, I thought, what happened to universal access and everything else? It was extraordinary and things. But I diverted again. But I think tech can be a solution for everything.
No worries. Well, kind of the flip side.
What would you pick? Is there something you would pick?
Good question.
We've never been asked this question before.
Yeah, turn the tables on us here.
This is the first podcast guest to ever flip it on us, surprisingly. There are some things, we've had some interesting answers in the past. Chris from Sifted, who's a really smart dude, he was like, there are just certain significant elements of construction that just involve
you know, lots of large amounts of tonnage needing to be transported from place to place. To some extent, agriculture, although, you know, maybe what the war in Ukraine has actually shown us is there needs to be more innovative tech solutions to automated skyscrapers full of, you know, produce, which is a fully feasible tech project that has been dreamt up 20 years ago. And I think Saudi Arabia might be putting in place at the moment. You know, I think from us, for the most part, my view is there are certain large sort of hardware and infrastructure problems that tech can maybe improve 10 to 15 to 20% in terms of efficiency, but ultimately just require someone with a massive truck to go pick up a huge amount of steel and drive it somewhere. And so there's only so much you can solve for that with tech. I think the other part of it that I do think is will forever be not entirely replicable is there is something unique about face-to-face human interaction. And while, you know, you can create a friendship online, you can't really have the same thing as in person. Like, it, you know, it is a very solid imitation, but it's only 60 to 70% of the way there. That is for me personally. I know there are other people that disagree with that. Paul, what would yours be?
Yeah, my default answer, it's not super game changing, but I think Slack is really a powerful tool. Like, it's something to use all the time. And I know it's just messaging software, but I think like this platform, you probably mentioned Teams, but like anything like that, that kind of makes the office digital and adds an element of like fun and joviality, you know, emojis on the, you used to not be able to put emojis on your coworker's comment person, for example, but now you can. I think stuff like that, put in GIFs and, you know, make it a little bit fun. I think it's pretty transformational and it's something that people are using at scale. I think the history of Slack is really interesting. I think they initially tried to start a video game and then they were using Slack as like the messaging service to create the video game. And then they're like, wait, this is the product. So check out that episode. I think it was how I built this with Guy Raz. But yeah, I think it's a really, really powerful tool and changed my life, I think, on multiple levels from a work standpoint.
Yeah, I've used Slack and stuff as well. But I was thinking that, you know, what you were saying about human interaction, of course, I'm all about that. And it's one of the conversations that comes up quite a lot is this thing about, you know, kids being online. And is that a bad thing? You know, how does that affect relationships and that kind of stuff? And the reality is that I see that enhancing that, but also, you know, and of course, these things can be negatively effective and things. But the reality is that if, for instance, Facebook or something had been around when I was at school, it wasn't. But if it was, then I would still retain relationships with my mates at school. But as it is, I've struggled to people who I grew up with. I haven't been able to see. But nowadays, if I meet someone on holiday, you know, and I can continue to stay in touch with them, even if we don't, you know, always get together and things.
To move us forward here, just curious to kind of flip that question a little bit. What do you think is the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there? Kind of your tech for bad answer.
Well, do you know, I thought my answer to this would be all of it. And this is really that. So, which of course flies in the face completely of my other answers and stuff. And that is because I don't know about you guys, but the times in my life when I just would like to just throw it all away and not have any more email, you know, just get off grid, get off whatever it is, whatever you call it and stuff sometimes. Because much as I see how it enhances my life and stuff, I also see how much it sort of ends up controlling it and managing it and that kind of thing as well. In reality, I think we've all been offline sometimes because of not being able to get on the internet, or we've chucked our phone out the window and said, shut it, you know. And then we're out there 2 minutes later trying to find that phone, aren't we? Kind of, oh my God. So I don't think there's any plenty of evil products out there, I'm sure. But the reality is that I think tech can all be bad for us as well sometimes. And we need just to make sure that we've got time for that human interaction, William, you talked about and things too. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, that's one of the, again, a unique one. We've not had that before. But yeah, I do think there's a lot to be said for it's like tech can be built for good. And don't forget, you can turn it off. Like, you know, you can go for a weekend away and it doesn't have to be in control of your life. And again, you know, it's that educational component of like, you don't have to be on Instagram 7 days a week. It can be three and you can get some benefits from it, et cetera, et cetera.
We're just about to go on holiday, and we're pleased to say, but the question my two boys asked, can I get online? You know, is it, and I'm like, you know, it's actually fundamental though. You know, we can't go anywhere where that's not available, I'm just saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Maybe moving into a slightly happier realm, if you could dream up a new tech product, what would the problem that it solved be and for whom?
I think that something that I share with my trustees on that is this idea of a school device. And that is that because I'm a huge believer in equity. And I know that there are some schools, for instance, that get, if some kids get a Microsoft Surface and others are getting a Hewlett Packard something or other, there'll be fights, you know, because somebody will deem their other devices to be better than, you know. And so there's something wonderful and equitable. I mean, for me, when I was at school, we all had the same textbook, basically speaking, you know, a device that was protected and had all those kind of things naturally inbuilt to it, that was affordable for everybody, for schools and things, but still did everything it needs to do. We're not so far off that. In reality, it might be two or three devices. It might be one for primary schools, for instance, which might be kind of like a tablet. There might be one for, you know, early secondary school where it's maybe with a separate keyboard and things, and then obviously something more for the youngsters. But there's something lovely and equitable about that. You're not fighting over who's got the fastest, newest, latest doodad. You know, it's everybody's got the same. So that would be my wish.
Super curious to hear your answer on this question, which is sort of a prediction question, because I think, you know, I believe your organization and your partners have set 2030 as your goal for kind of ending digital poverty and addressing that core issue. Curious to hear what your predictions are for the tech space or tech for good space kind of leading up to that, you know, very ambitious goal. What do you see happening or needing to happen moving towards 2030 to help you and your partners achieve that goal of ending digital poverty?
As I said earlier on, if you'd asked me 2 or 3 years ago, said 2 or 3 years from now, the DfE will hand out 1.5 million devices to youngsters and stuff, I would have been like, that would have been just a complete dream come true. And to a certain extent, it is. I think when I look forward, the game changing has to be maybe not universal, but free access to connectivity. Devices are doable, skills are doable. There are plenty of wonderful people out there who are able to do that. But the issue is that it is connectivity. There has to be long-term affordable connectivity. So that's something absolutely that we and others are going to be working on. There has to be some of the kind of stuff that William talked about too, which is around systemic change. There has to be a recognition that this is a good investment for every angle. This is not just about individuals. It's about communities and the nation as a whole. So what would my big prediction be? I would love to say that digital is now recognized as being, you know, digital connectivity. But I'm also just aware right at the moment that war in Ukraine, inflation, energy bills, in all of these things, unfortunately, all joined together to mean that digital. I don't think digital will be high up enough people's agendas in the next 12 months or something. And that's going to be a real focus for us. And so digital marketing specialists such as yourselves can help us to do that. I think that's going to be the thing, is to keeping that on people's agendas, whether that's government or communities and things. And might talk to you later about how you can help us to make that happen. Yeah,
we'd love to help. Anyway, again, it's something we think about often too, especially coming out of the pandemic that started our agency, just thinking about people being pushed in various ways, good and bad, online to engage with services and content. And obviously, to some extent, you know, we like that because we're content and digital marketing providers. But yeah, if there's any way we can pitch in, do let us know.
Sure. Thanks.
Just to round out the discussion and take us to our last question here, it's, you know, a bit of a personal question, but one thing we like to talk about in the tech for good space is how folks balance profit and purpose. You know, got to keep the lights on, got to pay the bills, but also, you know, they want to serve. Something it seems like you've done quite well in terms of, you know, serving the community and addressing this major issue of digital poverty. So just curious how you've done that in your own career. How have you balanced supporting, you mentioned you have two young kids, supporting your family, but also achieving a laudable purpose?
That's a big question, Paul. The answer is that I feel like I'm, for instance, not a career in tech, of course. That's one of the big differences. I think my career is about people and things. And I worked out very, very early on, luckily for me, I think, that I wanted to retain my principles and my ambitions for society and so forth. Working in the charitable sector has given me the opportunity to do all of that. There are sacrifices, of course. And, you know, I realize now I'm going to have to work until I'm about 200 years old for my boys to have grown up and that kind of thing. I don't have to balance profit with purpose in a way. I'm all about purpose. But you're right, I've got to keep the lights on. So Curry's giving me a call that time. It was super helpful. And right now we're talking to more organisations about wanting to support us. But I'm not giving you the best answer on this, and I'm not sure why. But I would say that one of the things that's really important for me, and which is why I went to Vietnam, is that I got a bit disenchanted with that money and what did it really do? You know, did it make any change? In Vietnam, you could get $100 and I would see that child there, go to school next week. And I would see that child, because you were supporting them every day, go up and go to university, because I was there long enough, 7-8 years, to see these youngsters grow up into university. So, I mean, there's something fantastic rewarding about that. And so for me, it's about turning the kind of profits that you might make, for instance, into purpose, to make sure that their actual that investment turns into change. And and it's when you see it happening, just like you guys, when you put a great campaign together, it's just something that just lifts your heart. And I feel very, very lucky to have had that in my life for as long as I have.
Oh,
I'm going to cry now.
Well, that'll be a first. That'll be a first in the podcast. We haven't had crying yet, but we welcome it.
Okay, well, yeah, okay. No, it's just wonderful to see young people grow up feeling engaged and happy and looking forward to their lives and stuff, rather than the struggles that so many of them have to go through.
Of course. Yeah, it's something as a former educator I definitely connect with deeply, and that's why we prioritize working with nonprofits and charities and, you know, ed tech, for example, so they can produce great products that, you know, very much to your point, help young people grow and learn. And yeah, we try to, you know, keep those dual missions connected as much as possible in our work. So
fantastic.
So yeah, thank you for sharing your story with us today, Paul.
A pleasure. So let's say, if any of your listeners are interested in understanding a bit more, then we are at digitalpovertyalliance.org. We have a fantastic hub too, which is run by Mighty Networks. In fact, you can find access to all of those kind of things on our website under learningfoundation.org.uk. Super happy to hear from anybody, however they might want to help participate, but that's, you know, pledging to support the ambitions or something else. So thank you very much for the opportunity of talking to you guys and for talking to your audiences and things too.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for jumping on, and thank you everyone for listening. This has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast by Literal Humans. We're joined today by Paul Finnis, CEO of the Learning Foundation and the Digital Poverty Alliance.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great day.